Well, I was, I guess, especially moved during the well-being ceremony because my root teacher, Roshi Diane Martin, is very ill. And in the context of her husband having fallen and broken his hip, also has disabilities from a stroke and is in a hospital, and she can't get to him. And there are people in my family who are suffering kind of chronic pain issues, and you know, it just brings it all home that suffering is universal. We all suffer. And to offer a well-being ceremony is our way of bringing compassion to each of us who suffer, and especially the people that we called their names out today. So we bring our suffering here, and we are especially very fortunate at Valley Streams because we now regularly offer a full moon ceremony. We try to connect it with when there's actually a full moon out, but it's a regular ceremony where we're given the opportunity to be offered the precepts. And, you know, some people say that receiving the precepts is sort of at the heart of our practice life. And it's sort of hard to say, really, what are the precepts? They are an offering of a kind of guidance to awaken us to our human condition, really. They're grounded in naming all of the most important human tendencies that we all live with in our socially conditioned lives, you know, like greed or hunger for more or, you know, protecting ourselves and maybe hurting other people, you know, feeling anger or resentment. I mean, there's so many ways that our human condition conditions us to act in such a way that we cause suffering in other people and actually cause suffering in ourselves. And so the precepts really begin by offering us to be grounded in, you know, how we are living in our humanity, and then giving us an awakened capacity to receive and practice with that will move us in kind of a transformational process into a way of life where we're no longer bound by our sense of separateness, no longer bound by holding on to self, but are free, really, to bring compassion and wisdom to the world. And it's, in some ways, it's kind of a miracle that we can, through this practice life, receive this kind of transformation. So in the full moon ceremony, we begin by taking the refuges. And the refuges are, you know, the first step as we enter this ceremony, where we bring all of our hardships and our worries and our questions and also our desire to live the Dharma. And we offer it and take refuge in the Buddha. And as the chant goes, we take refuge in the Buddha and we awaken true mind. We take refuge in the Dharma. And we receive the mercy from the ocean of truth. And we take refuge in Sangha, and that awakens our potential to live in harmony with other beings. So when we chant the refuges, we're awakening these capacities to receive the true mind, to rest in the merciful ocean, and to bring harmony to everyone. And then after taking refuge in this ceremony, we're offered the precepts. And in the ceremony, we vow and we receive the precept. So let me say a little more, because the precepts, as I said, are offering us like a transformational process out of our human tendencies. So for example, the precepts come kind of via negativa. So one precept would be like, I vow not to kill. And that negativa actually grounds us in the truth that, you know, living itself means that we kill. I mean, we kill the plants that we eat. We might step on a bug. But as we take this in, then we're given the possibility of asking the question, like, well, what does that mean, I vow not to kill? And in that process, what that means begins to open up. Like, I vow not to kill might mean, I vow not to be so harsh with myself. I vow not to kill might mean looking for what's alive and good in the other person. So as we sit with the via negativa in the vow, in the precepts, we begin to open up the conditions of our lives, not hold on so tight. And in that process then, if we sit with the precept, something comes in from the universal, from the transformational, that begins to interact with this inquiry that we're involved in and moving us in the direction to live an awakened life. There are three great pure precepts and 10 grave precepts, and many people here I know have already studied the precepts and understand a lot about this, but I'm not going to go into all of them. I'm going to sort of lay the groundwork for any engagement with any of the precepts, and then in a little while we're going to work with one so that you can get a feeling for how this might happen. Because I want to begin with the fact that the act of receiving the precept, it's offered to us in the full moon ceremony, but the act of receiving the precept begins with, I vow not to kill. I vow not to abuse sexuality. So it seems like it might be interesting to open freshly and even wonder, well, what does that mean to vow? We say it a lot. In fact, we just chanted it before I started to speak. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. I vow to taste, and it's even using the word taste, the Tathagata's words. So one way to understand this is that vow means to promise, but it's more than a promise. It's a sacred promise. It's a promise that we make that is endless. It's a promise that is so deep that we don't want to violate the vow in any way, even though we might, because we're learning and we are trying and we, you know, don't understand and we make mistakes. But the commitment to live the promise becomes very, very important. I learned from Okamura that in the Japanese language, the word vow means to wish. And this seems to me to be part of what we mean in our Buddhist Dharma life, that when we vow, we're making a promise, but we're also wishing to be able to live the Buddha way. We want to be transformed and awakened to the life of giving and take and caring for the world. We want to let go of the tiny selves that hold us back. So in vowing, we're both promising and wishing at the same time. But often, it seems to me, at least it's my experience, that when we say these chants, and we also say these chants at the end of a talk, we say, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Yeah. That's a lot. And I find sometimes when I'm chanting these things, I suddenly become aware that, you know, it's just kind of rote. You know, I'm just saying the words. I'm not really with it, so to speak. And it seems easy because they're familiar. We know the chant, we've said it over and over again. And so what are we called to consider each time we say that, I vow? You know, how do we express vow in our lives? And when we come here to practice, maybe when we enter the door, maybe our bow to the altar as we enter the door is a kind of vow. We're stepping in to, you know, this deep practice that we're committed to. But also to be aware, maybe I'm not into this. I'm not sure I want to vow. That's part of the honesty of it all. And maybe we'll go through times when we're right there wholehearted and other times when we call this all into question. But we want to be mindful. We want to pay attention. When we vow, are we expressing, not just saying the words? You could say, are our hands vowing? Are my feet vowing? Is my heart vowing? Do we taste the Dharma? Do we let the Dharma penetrate, permeate our whole being? Because does it go into our blood, our bones? Do we soak it in like the rain? Does it resonate? Sometimes I think of it like ghee pouring down from the sky. You know, receiving the vow is to want and then to receive. So first we start with a vow. And this is just to maybe quicken a little reflection. You know, what does vow mean to you? Or what happens when you chant? Or what happens when we bow? What happens when you consider what it means to vow, to promise, this sacred promise, to live this life no matter what? I'll never forget the first time, this is years ago, and I don't know, several things happened in my Sangha life that I had felt hurt by or angry about, and, you know, part of me was, well, I'm not coming back there. You know, I had that first thought, but then what came so strong was, no matter what, I want to practice. No matter if nobody likes me, I want to practice. So that sense of surety, you know, for me was a kind of recognition of a vow that I had made and that I want to keep. Just to turn now to the precepts again, and I want to tell you a story of Upalavana. I don't know if you've heard of Upalavana, but when we chant the ancestors, I think she's the 13th one. I'm not sure. However, that is a little confusing to me because she apparently was one of two of the most select nuns that the Buddha had appointed. So she practiced with the Buddha, and I guess the Buddha especially honored her for her psychic powers. But she also had a very tumultuous life as a wife and a courtesan before she came to Buddhism. But here's the story that comes from India in the 6th century BC. The nun Upalavana was a disciple of Buddha. She visited the homes of some noble young women and encouraged them to become nuns. They responded, "We are young and beautiful and full of life. It would be hard for us to keep the precepts." Upalavana said, "If you break the precepts, you break the precepts. First, leave the household and become nuns." The women said to her, "If we break the precepts, we will fall into hell. Why would you have us do that? And Upalavana said, go ahead, fall into hell. The women all laughed. Why would you suggest such a thing? And then Upalavana says, in a former life, I was a prostitute and an entertainer. One day, I dressed myself in nun's clothes in front of my customers as a joke. And because of that, in my next life, I became a nun and took the precepts. So her story goes on, and in some ways, maybe it's hard to relate to this story. I mean, I don't think most of us here would want to just leave our wonderful lives and, you know, become sort of monastic. Some of us might want to become monastic, but it's not about leaving our lives. It's about being in our lives in a different way, I think, is what we're talking about now. And we're not, I don't know, I don't think of former lives and future lives and all of that. Maybe some of you do, but I think if we don't take this literally, there's something very important here that really had a big impact on me when I read this many years ago. Because at the end of the story, she says, I learned that you can attain the fruit of the way even if you break the precept and fall into hell. The merit of receiving the precepts makes awakening possible. But if you never receive the precepts and do unwholesome things, you will never attain the way. So I don't know if this makes sense, but for me it was like, oh, I see. It's by engaging the precepts offering of a possibility of an enlightened life that then changes what it means to kind of break the precept or fall into hell. Because that enlightened way is already working with you inside to become awake. But if you just break what could be considered a precept in a sort of secular life, then you just go on with your life in the sort of, you know, usual way that it is. So this is an invitation. Many of you have taken the precepts or received the precepts and have practiced with it, but even now to consider such a value of bringing the precepts into your practice life so that there's an opening that continues to happen. And to kind of fill this out a little more, it seems like what's important is that to receive a precept is to enter the field of non-duality. Because if we hear the precept, I vow not to kill, for example, in our usual state of consciousness, it's impossible to not kill. And so we're presented with a conundrum. I'm vowing not to kill, but I will always kill. And so in a way, to live the precept feels impossible. But if we can look more deeply into what each precept means, we see that something is breaking open. The emptiness of all things is beginning to arise and present a different way of acting and being. And that connection, I guess, with the emptiness, with the suchness itself, begins to break down the sense of self and open us into a connection with everything. And whatever we're acting in, we're acting as part of a whole, no longer an I, no longer a separate self. So I had one way of thinking about this for myself, that the precepts are like seeds of awakening, of possibility, of a different way of life that are planted inside when we receive the precept. And vow is sort of like the womb, the womb that's holding the gestation that's happening. And that vow becomes the container within which we can grow and develop into the Bodhisattva way of living and being lived for the benefit of all beings. So we vow, we sit, I'm sorry, we vow, we receive, we sit zazen, and giving arises. That the expression of the gifts of compassion and wisdom just arise. So what I'm going to suggest that we do tonight is just consider one precept. And the one that I've picked is, I vow not to be avaricious. I vow not to be avaricious. And just sit with that for a moment, wondering what that might mean. Wanting to hold on to something tight, wanting to, you know, make sure you have everything you need, when actually the transformation of this vow would be to not be possessive of anything, but to be generous. The sort of counterpoint is the freedom to be generous, to not hold on, to not hold grudges, to not be stingy. The Zen peacemakers say, I will not foster a mind of poverty in myself or others, and will use all the ingredients of my life, giving my best effort and accepting the result. So not to be avaricious means not to be stingy with our lives, to be free to give, you know, from all parts of ourselves. Zenju Erthalyn Emanuel says, we are to give freely, which in this precept means to share the wisdom that arises from our life experiences. We let it go and not use the wisdom to think so highly of ourselves or withhold it from those we feel are not worthy. Not to be avaricious means to give of our own wisdom, give of our experience, you know, for the sake of you know, the well-being of the other person. So I'm going to just offer a couple of examples, because I think what happens when we work with a precept is that we grow in the meanings of what it means, kind of. So one thing is that I think that I often have had to have an experience of someone being generous to me before I could be generous to somebody else. And this stood out for me especially last year. I took an 8-week class with Reverend Lien Chit, who's a Vietnamese-American priest who wrote a book called Home is Here, and especially is offering her bodhisattva work for Asian people, people of Asian heritage. And so I joined this group, and only 4 of us were white. The rest of us, maybe, you know, 12 or 15 other people were Asian American. And so we read the first chapters of the book for the next meeting, and, you know, I had some thoughts and questions and wanted to say something, and a discussion ensued, and I raised my hand, and you know, Reverend Shutt kept calling on the other Asian American people. And we got to the end of the meeting, and I hadn't been called on. And so all of a sudden, out of the blue, she said, oh, Dora Lee, would you be willing to offer the dedication of merit for the group? And so, I felt kind of warm about that and glad, and so I offered, you know, the dedication of merit. And then the meeting was over. And I thought about this, and I realized that her doing that was an act of generosity. Because first of all, I had to look inside and realize, oh, I'm actually more anxious about being in the minority as a white person than I had any idea I was. And that actually, through her gift to me of generosity, I could feel that what I can best bring to this group is deep listening to other people's experience, because there's so much I could learn from them. And so I felt free to offer that rather than, oh, please call on me. You know? So often I think we receive generosity, and that's what cultivates this capacity to move from wanting to hold on to something versus letting go. And then sometimes we notice, or I notice, a constricted body sensation, like, ooh, I don't know if I want to get close to that person, or something like that. I'm not sure I want to, you know, clean up after, well, this actually happened to me when I was in my office working and I was about to leave and there were all these dirty cups in the sink and I was really pissed off because people didn't wash their cups and I thought, I'm just going to wash my cup and leave the rest. And then, you know, but something comes in and says, you know, even if you don't like it, you know, we can shift, we can act differently. And so I said, well, okay, I'm going to just wash all the cups. And just doing that, I felt so much better. And then somebody else came, another clinician came, she was leaving, and the fact that I had to stay longer to wash all the cups, it meant, oh, now we can talk to each other. You know, so there's kind of this stream of things that start to happen out of our practice of generosity. And then often, I don't know, how do we cultivate a capacity to give unconditionally? I have a friend, and she told me I can tell this story. She's a deeply religious Jew and also a Buddhist practitioner, and she's very strongly wanting to support the people of Gaza and has gone to Israel to go to Gaza and actually stand in front of the farms where they're picking the olives so that the Israeli soldiers won't come in and destroy the olive trees. But she went over there recently, and everything is so difficult there now that these programs weren't working. And she's my age, and there are all these young people. She felt extremely lonely. And she contacted a friend in California who contacted somebody in Israel who invited her to come for Shabbat. And so she drove, she took the bus for 2 hours to get to this stranger's home. And they welcomed her in and they fed her. They let her stay there for 4 days. And she felt some kind of warmth coming back into her heart. And she shared her political views with this family. And they adamantly did not agree with her. So she was very moved that even with that knowing of that difference and that conflict, they gave unconditionally for her. It didn't hold them back from generosity. So maybe just by these examples and by your own experience, you can see how maybe we grow into our capacity to be generous. Maybe we grow into even knowing what being generous is. Like, I've had somebody confront me on my racist behavior, but they did it in such a way that it was a generous gift. I could hear it. I could learn from it. What are all the ways in which we offer the Dharma as a generous gift? All the different ways that we share what our own wisdom and compassion with others. So we live with these questions. We actually never leave the conundrum of our conditioned lives and the Buddha way. But we vow, we receive, we practice Zazen, and giving begins to happen. So the precepts are like seeds that are planted within the womb of vow and cultivated through our Zazen practice, growing our capacity to live an awakened life for the benefit of all beings. So those are my thoughts, and I want to just offer a little time for some discussion, but then I have a little exercise that I thought we could engage in, just to, you know, sort of bring to life some of what I've been talking about. So any thoughts that want to be shared first, or? No? Oscar. Oh, Jody. Oh.
I just wanted to thank you, Jolie, for expanding the idea of being avaricious to that, to not withholding whatever it is that you have for whatever reason, fear or fear of somehow giving up something that there may not be enough of, which I think is an illusion. So appreciate that very much.
I also want to thank you, Doralee. That was a very, very beautiful Dharma talk. And I don't know, I was particularly struck by the idea that when we're vowing, we're also wishing. We're promising and we're wishing. And just the fluidity of it. And, you know, because a lot of times when I say, you know, I promise or I vow, it just feels really like, yeah, I'm going to do that, you know, very hard and rigid. Not rigid, but like, you know, it's very like strict or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to think about this more in with the idea that everything is just sort of flowing along, mm-hmm. is very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for hearing that. Jim.
Yeah, I was really struck by your image of the precept as the seed or the germ, and the womb as a nurturing, you know, envelope for the precept. And I think that's a wonderful image. Of course, you know, the womb naturally nourishes what is inside. Maybe, you know, we don't feel so natural, you know, nourishing the precepts, but maybe over time we, seems like we gain, you know, the will or the spiritual fortitude to nurture the precepts. And then, you know, become more, you know, we can live with them more easily. And I think that's a wonderful image. Thank you.
Yeah. And yes, it's like this whole practice is one of non-judgment or non-evaluation or telling ourselves we should be different. It's a deeply compassionate way of seeing and becoming aware. I mean, all of these, you know, I vow not to kill, all of these ways, our tendencies, it's part of our human nature. And if we can be aware of them and then open them up more, like what does it mean to not kill? That's a gentle kind of a process where more comes. Life breaks through, and the Dharma then eases all the boundaries of our hindrances. We can move into the flow of being fully present for each other. Yeah. Well, oh, yes.
thank you, Doralee, that I'm, you know, relatively early on in working with precepts and things, but I grew up in a very strict Catholic background, and so, you know, the first time I ever heard anything to do with precepts, it sounded like, oh, commandments. And, and I really love the way you're presenting them as something to not hold so tightly, and how they, like was also mentioned, a vow and a wish, that, you know, it almost feels like the opposite of what was drilled into me as a child, and it makes it more meaningful that way. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. And this is about practicing in your zazen with a precept, because we want to enter into samadhi. We want to enter into that different state where the dualities are not in charge. We want to get underneath the surface life, and that's where the precept really can be at work. So the zazen, bringing it into your practice, is really, I think, what practice is. So, okay, so are you? I hope you're open to this exercise. I want to break up into pairs so that each of us will have a chance to share. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm just looking at the Zoom people. So maybe two groups of two and one group of three, I guess it will have to be. Oh, there's six. Oh, okay. Okay, great. So Anthony will put you into small groups, and I want you to first have one round where I'm going to invite you to sense your life and to share a turning point in your life where you received generosity. And each take a turn to share that experience. And of course, if you're not comfortable sharing, that's okay too. I don't want people to feel pressured at all. So you could sit in quiet or listen to the other person and not necessarily share. But anyway, it's an invitation to consider an experience, a turning point where you received generosity. Okay, and then I'll time that. And then the second question would be to consider when your practice life opened up your capacity to be generous, or maybe opened up your capacity to see a way that you're not being generous. Could be both ways. So I'll plant both of those questions at the beginning, because the second one might take a little more listening inside. So if we just do it this way, like 1, 2, let's see, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Is that okay? 1, 2, 1, 2. Oh. What did you say, Karen?
Tell us again.
Okay. 1, 2. Yes. Yes. And you, Sarah, John, Karen, Susan, Alan, and Oscar. Oscar. You're pairing with the person behind you, Alan.
I'm your partner.
Okay. Okay. Kenny, Dave, Sage, Katrina, Malia, Patrick, and Jim, and me.
Okay.
Okay. And so, okay, so we'll give each person like 3 minutes, and Jody, maybe I'll take the bell so I can, like, Okay, so I'll give you a warning before you switch, but you can monitor the two of you taking kind of equal time to share.
Should I go first?
Okay.
Well, you know, the funny thing that came to my mind was something that happened a long time ago.
Yeah.
When I went to college, I took a class in drama.
In what?
Drama.
Oh, drama.
A drama class. Mm-hmm. Not an acting class, but
yeah.
A class about, you have your mic on, which maybe some
wait.
Our conversation is going to be broadcast. So.
Yeah, there we go. So the professor offered to take people in the class. I went to school in Santa Barbara, and he offered to take us to Los Angeles to see a Molière play. And it was an optional thing. And I signed up for it and went, and I had never been to a play in my entire life. No, never been to a play. Nobody had ever taken me to a play. And I was completely smitten with the professor and going to LA and seeing the play, and it just opened my consciousness up, and like, this is something I've never done. It's so novel and cultured and wonderful, and how did I miss out on this all my life? I never even knew such a thing was possible, and I felt maybe for the first time like an adult. You know, like I was an adult, and this person was taking me seriously. And I mean, I was with a group, a small group, but we went out to dinner, and it was just like, wow, this is. I'm an adult, you know. I'm doing the adult. I'm having this. You know, I was like a freshman in college, right? You know, I was like 18. You know. Yeah, but it was so amazing, and it was. You know, probably the professor didn't know how generous it was, you know, for me. But it was really life changing. It opened up vistas that I had never. Yeah.
Seeing the world.
Yeah.
The theater.
Yeah. Going to a Molière play.
Part of the group.
And
maybe, I guess I've been wondering myself too about when there are these together. Maybe this person doesn't really know what you know. It comes from a place, the bigger space, more than what the person is. And they think of themselves as something like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know, you know what. But it was for me, it was a very exciting moment in my life.
Something being cultivated in you from that point.
Right.
Okay, so I shared one recently that one thing that was life changing for me when my mentor, Lucy Enlin, was teaching me all about focusing and how to attend to inside and things like that. And many people, you know, when they listen, they kind of do it in this rote kind of way.
They what?
Parrot the words you say, or, you know, it's not like deep listening. But one day we were on the by Lake Michigan together in Evanston, and we had agreed we were going to do. He was going to do focusing. I just and I was committed to reading until I actually felt. And it was just amazing to me because I probably had inspired more people to
with complete presence, with no impatience, with no So, and he waited, and that gave me the capacity to go off that It was very moving. I felt very excited about the rocket that would honor my process that exquisitely to anything to turn me in any direction at all. And I don't know if I've ever done that quite that way. Myself.
Sounds like you felt really received at that time, right?
Yeah. Allowed to be. That's how I was. Is that what you're talking about? Chops during the hot season.
That was my teacher.
Yeah.
Our examples, I don't have a.
Settle down at that level. Okay. So take your time, but consider getting ready to go to the second question. Share a time in your practice life, what that was like when something opened your capacity to be generous, or maybe it also showed a way in which you aren't being generous. It could go both ways. Does that make sense?
Well, I'm trying to be generous right now with someone who it's difficult to be generous with, and it's happening right now, actually, you know, I mean, in the present days.
Very much real.
And so I'm trying to be generous, even though I'm not sure the person will see it as generous or receive it as generous or be very keen on the way that I'm posing to be generous. I think I'm being generous, but I'm also open to the other person not agreeing that I am being generous or in the way that they want generosity. So, but I'm committed to being generous in the way that I think would be helpful, and I'm also committed to being rejected. I feel pretty equanimous about either being rejected or sent in a completely different direction for my generosity. But the motivation is that I care about this person, and I want a good outcome for them in a difficult circumstance. And I have an idea about something that would be that would take things in their situation in a better, you know, more positive direction. But I don't know if it's I don't know if they can hear it. I don't know if they want to go in that direction exactly. And I think I might be rejected as or. At least my initial idea may be rejected, and maybe there'll be some further suggestion of how I could redirect my generosity. I'm committed to it, and so I'm kind of doing it on the basis of a vow or a strong intention to try to do a generous thing.
knowing that I may be off base. I could be off base in terms of what this other person wants. Yeah, I just don't know what they want.
You're practicing helping
so I don't know what to
for your office.
To come along.
Yeah.
The degree that you want to prepare yourself so that you're still grounded in the
I wrote this letter today, actually, that is proposing the terms of my generosity, and there's many assumptions in it that I'm telling the person that, you know, I recognize there's all these assumptions in there that are my assumptions, and they may not be your assumptions. So please take this as, you know, like, it's completely a suggestion of how to proceed in this situation, but here it, you know, this is the way I would go about it as far as I can see, and I'm completely open to your way of going about it that may be different in particular or in general. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like what Zendu was talking about, offering your wisdom, but at the same time, you're doing it for
yourself.
Not to stay past, maybe afterwards,
no.
But to offer it. Standing in the Buddha way.
Oh.
Standing in the act.
Yeah. Right. With no expectation. Or, you know, some expectation, but not of a particular outcome. And a particular, like the strategy could change, but maybe the goal could, you know, endure. I just don't know. I just don't know. Right. I do not know the next step. Okay, your turn.
I know. So just take a couple more minutes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh.
I know.
Wow, this time I'm not going to buy
Christmas. Well, I mean, if I can express it all now, but I practice my, you know, I have this strange daughter.
Yeah.
Which has been very difficult.
Yeah.
And she, just out of the blue, invited us to come over and that particular day. And it was really hard to find how I wanted to go. We agreed to go, but how do I go to go without all the shock? And I found this place where I realized, okay, I'm going there to witness everything. Whatever, but I mean, I wasn't there to expect anything. But I think that was an act of generosity because I was being there in the life she's now, which is the life. From my perspective, it has issues in it.
Right.
For her, it's something of value.
Trying not to be the mother, you know, overseer.
And I forget about it. And then it freed me because I didn't feel any of the work.
So you were contemplating this, or you did it?
No, I did, yeah. No, I already did this.
No, I see.
And so I wasn't dreaming.
You thought it through. Yeah. You thought how you were going to be and generous, you know, in non-judgment.
And I think the witness means I also have this space. So I just
Yeah. You too are standing on the ground, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Standing in yourself.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
You want to put the mic back on?
Well, it feels like at least these conversations could go on. Thank you all for participating. And as we come to a close, looks like some people on Zoom have left. Yeah. But is there anything that you would like to share with the whole group about this experience just before we end this evening? Sarah?
Thank you so much, Dorothy. This was just a lovely, lovely conversation.
Oh, great. Great.
Thank you for your generosity and offering this.
Be generous for you.
Thank you for your generosity and allowing us to discuss general. You know, one thing Kenny and I were discussing a little bit was being generous and allowing other people to be generous towards us. You know, sometimes we people might be offering something of themselves or something, and we don't want to deal with it. And, but, you know, just, I mean, you have to have, you know, we have to have our limits. We have to have our boundaries, of course.
Right. But it, sometimes it's hard to receive.
Sometimes it is hard to receive.
Oh, no, that's okay. You don't have to do that.
But it can mean something to allow that person to make this little effort.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, maybe what's important, too, is it goes both ways. Like, you know, that generosity coming to you elicits your generosity in receiving. And so it is like the giver, gift, and receiver are one. Once you're in that field, then it reverberates back and forth. And that's the beauty of it, really. Yeah. Anybody else? Thank you so much, everyone.